Don't Stop, Get It, Get It is episode 42 of For Our Edification. Thank you for downloading this episode of For Our Edification. I'm Eddie Francis. For Our Edification is brought to you by Edify Ventures, LLC, brand strategy for your people and you. Learn more at edifyventuresnola.com. Also, for past episodes of For Our Edification, go to eddiefrancis.com. You can also catch some episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And last thing, you hear something that is interesting to you in a good way or in a not so good way, then reach out to me, Eddie at eddiefrancis.com. I would love to share your comment with people, only if it's good. Okay, all right, I'll be fair about it. This episode is an episode where I have something that is just on my brain, and that is the Freaknik documentary. And another thing on my brain, top HBCUs. We need to stop that conversation. The views and opinions expressed on For Our Edification do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the hosts, guests, or any entities with which we are affiliated. Thank you for joining me on this episode of For Our Edification. So, on my brain are the Freaknik documentary and the top HBCU conversation. And let's start with the Freaknik documentary. All right, so let me just get this out of the way. I never made it to Freaknik, and I really hate that I never made it to Freaknik, because I was in college when Freaknik was starting to really, really get hot. I started college in the fall of 1988, and I was initiated into Alpha in 89, the spring of 89, and then I was really in the thick of doing a lot of on-campus leadership stuff at my alma mater. Which is, my alma mater is a predominantly white institution, but being in a frat, I was always in contact with my frat brothers at conventions and Greek shows and all kinds of stuff. So there was always some mention of Freaknik around spring break time, right? Around 91 is when I was really, really involved. I was in the national oratorical competition for the fraternity, all this other good stuff. I was doing some student leadership stuff, and I just never made it to Freaknik, and I just kept hearing about it. Oh, man. But of course, because I'm in New Orleans, because I'm in driving distance, I would hear back from people who went to Freaknik, and I would hear from my frat brothers, and the stories were fun to listen to. They were a lot of fun to listen to. And so in watching the documentary, there were a couple of things that stood out to me. First of all, watch the documentary, check it out. It's a good documentary. But one thing that stands out to me is how people perceive Freaknik based on their experience. The second thing is how the documentary ended. So this perception thing, Freaknik had three stages. You know, there was the beginning, there was a rapid growth stage, and then there was the something else that it became. I really love that the documentary spoke to the folks who started Freaknik. And the thing that I love the most about their story is they're putting into context the actual term Freaknik. I remember how the word freak transitioned from one thing in black pop culture to another thing. And it was really interesting to watch that transition. And that's exactly what happened with the term Freaknik. It started as one thing, and then it became something else. So I really love that you get a chance to hear from the people who started it themselves about why they started it, and what they intended for it to be. It's really very simple, actually. And then you have the rapid growth phase from about the late 80s to the mid 90s. You have this rapid growth of it, and that's when I would hear stories. People would go to Freaknik, they would come back to New Orleans, and they would just say, man, Oh man, we had so much fun. Oh man, so and so, we did this and then we slept in a car. We did that. We found a we found an apartment of a friend of mine who goes to Clark Atlanta, and yeah, man, and we just, you know, and so hearing all those stories, I had that real feel for how big Freaknik was becoming, and I wanted so badly to be able to gather friends and jump in the car and go, but it just never happened for me. And then there's the something else phase, you know, when Freaknik just became something else. And at all three of these phases, it's interesting to hear the perception of what Freaknik is based on people's entry points. And so the perception that the people who started Freaknik have, that makes sense. They started the thing. I get that. But then you have the people who went during the rapid growth phase and the people who went through, who went during the something else phase, and they have their perceptions. And based on that documentary, it sounds like whatever people, wherever that entry point is, that is still their perception today of what Freaknik was. And honestly, this is where I'm going to get into the second thing that was really interesting about the documentary. It's really funny to me how some people are not letting their perception of what Freaknik was go. Like, they are hanging on for dear life to their perception of what Freaknik was. That brings me to the other thing that was so interesting about that documentary to me, and that is how the documentary ended. Without giving too much away, let's just say that the way I saw the documentary end, it ended on this note of defiance. And I really wonder why the director, P. Frank Williams, made that choice. So you have this buildup of what Freaknik started as, right? And then at some point in the documentary, they talk about this new version of Freaknik that's been happening in Atlanta. Very interesting point about that new Freaknik is it seems like the folks who started it, what they're really trying to do is they're trying to be a bit more purposeful in what that event is now. And yet the documentary kind of ends with this, yeah, well, this is what Freaknik really is, whatever. It kind of ends on that note. And I'm really curious as to why. I have to say that if I were one of the people who started Freaknik and I watched the documentary and I saw it end on that note, I would want to know, well, wait a minute. What about the voices of the people who started this thing? I mean, why do we not get the final say? I would be interested in that, because for those of us who wonder how certain things started, we find a lot of value in having the people who started it all have the last say as far as, well, this is how it started. I understand what it became. Hopefully it'll be this, or hopefully we can leave it at what it was. Having them have that final say, I think, is probably something that if I had been directing, I would have done, you know. Or I would have tried to arrange a meeting between the people who started Freaknik and the person who restarted Freaknik. I mean, but that's, you know, I wasn't involved, so obviously there's only so much I can say, right? So with that being said, with those two things that stood out to me, first of all, people's perceptions of what Freaknik, quote unquote, really is. And then second thing, how it ended. I would say this. Number one, watch the documentary. I would also say take in as many sides of the Freaknik experience as you can, because while there is this joyful side, and I'm going to talk about that in just a second, while there's this joyful side, they do talk about the dark side, and the dark side is very dark. And so take that in. The other thing I would say, something to take away from this Freaknik experience is at some point the term Black joy is used in the documentary. And I really appreciate that that term is applied to how it started and how it evolved. The thing that is interesting to me about that, and I'm going to tease out something. I'm forever, you know, I'm working on Halima to drag her back into an episode. And so Halima has this really cool thought about the power of Black joy as a social justice imperative. And so I think taking away from that documentary how Black joy can be more than just Black folks having fun, taking away how we can turn Black joy into something else, something bigger, something that really fortifies Black America, I think that there is a conversation to be had there. One more thing I want to leave you with about the Freaknik documentary. I don't know how many people from New Orleans remember this, but around the time that Freaknik ended, the then mayor of New Orleans, I don't know if I should say the name or not. I mean, all you got to do is look up the timeline and you'll see who it was. So I'm not so sure if this person would appreciate me saying this. But the then mayor of New Orleans had an interesting idea. And the interesting idea was to bring Freaknik to New Orleans. And I remember this vividly because I kind of got excited, but I kind of thought, I don't know. And it didn't work, obviously. But I will say this. New Orleans wound up having the grown and sexy Freaknik that we still have called Essence Festival. Anyway, I'll be back in just a sec because I have some thoughts about the quote unquote top HBCUs. Thank you for joining me on For Our Edification. I'm Eddie Francis, and For Our Edification is brought to you by Edify Ventures, brand strategy for your people, and you learn more at edifyventuresnola.com. So I am working on a project right now, a pretty big project. Well, big for me, a big project about, shall we say, promoting HBCUs. And I'm interviewing people for this project. And I had a thought while I was interviewing an alumna of Florida A&M recently. And on episode 38 of this podcast, I had Kimberly O'Neill, who is an alumna of North Carolina A&T. And going back to that episode, there was something that I asked Kimberly. And the question I asked her was, when people talk about the top HBCUs in the country, why is A&T never in that conversation as the largest HBCU in the country? Here's her answer.
This comes up a lot in terms mm-hmm. of why is it that we always see philanthropists and funders give money to Morehouse and Spelman mm. and Howard? And I do think, you know, people underestimate the needs of public schools. And yeah. So when you think about the private institutions, they typically have large mouthpieces, right, working mm-hmm. in community on their behalf, and they're pushing that narrative forward. They're private institutions. They don't get the same kind of funding. But the reality is our state institutions are underfunded as compared to their PWI yeah. counterparts. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I think the good thing about being under-recognized in that way is that when you do recognize the power in not just the A&T, because A&T is just magnificent, right? but when you look at, we are just magnificent. Aggie born, Aggie bred, you know, you learned that on day one. But when you get to learn about these other institutions, large and small, and whatever their niche areas are, you really realize how impactful HBCUs are around this country and the caliber of students that are coming out. And it really helps to me to dispel the myth that we just happened to get in HBCUs because we couldn't get into other institutions where there was no other choice for me. And HBCU was the choice for me. I applied to the other institutions in case an HBCU didn't want me.
Again, that's Kimberly O'Neill, episode 38 of For Our Edification. And so I want to unpack this. And there's a reason for this. Between that conversation I had with Kimberly about A&T not being included in the top, and then also speaking to this Florida A&M alumna, you know, I started to wonder. I look at the roster of alumni from a lot of HBCUs, and I took note of the roster of alumni from Florida A&M. And I started thinking to myself, maybe when we talk about the top HBCUs, we should be much more intentional. Maybe we should get away from this top four conversation. Now, if you don't know what the top four conversation is, the top four conversation is almost always, if not always, Hampton, Howard, Spelman, Morehouse. And maybe that is limited to a particular region. I'm not exactly sure, but that's when you talk to people casually, when you see conversations about the top HBCUs on social media, those are the ones that come up all the time, right? And so I'm thinking to myself, well, number one, it's really interesting that it's four. Why not a top five? We always talk about a top five. Why not a top five? But people know good and well that A&T is the biggest one. And then not only that, you have FAMU that has probably the strongest brand, of the HBCUs, definitely one of the strongest brands in higher education. FAMU has an incredibly strong brand for a lot of different reasons. It goes well beyond athletics. And I think that this top HBCU conversation is one that needs some context. You heard Kimberly's take on, you know, when it comes down to fundraising, there's a particular conversation. As a marketer, for me, it's also about brand. I think out of all the HBCUs, I think without question, the ones that have the strongest brands, Howard is always in there, and Howard has one of the strongest brands in higher ed as well. The same goes for Spelman and Morehouse, strongest brands in higher ed across the board. FAMU definitely is a part of that conversation. Ironically, while I think that North Carolina A&T's marketing is very strong, very, very strong, it's interesting to me that they are not regularly part of a conversation, of a casual conversation. Again, maybe that for me, that's the Deep South ears that I have that's talking. If I'm on the East Coast, though, this might be a completely different conversation. And I think that's another thing to consider about this top HBCU conversation, right? I graduated from Tennessee State. Why are we not in this top conversation? Heck, I'm from New Orleans, where we have the biggest producer of black doctors in the nation, Xavier University of Louisiana. Why is Xavier not a regular part of the top HBCU conversation, right? I worked at Dillard. Dillard could easily be thrown in that conversation. A lot of people have a wealth of respect for Dillard. What about Morgan State? What about Norfolk State? So you have all of these different HBCUs. So my point is this, and I know if you're listening to me, you're probably sitting there going, oh, why don't we just list all of them? And damn it, that's my point. That is my point. Of course, we can't list all 100 plus, right, as the top HBCUs, because it's all of them. But, and it doesn't qualify top very well if you list every single one. But that is my point. Let's get away from the quote unquote top HBCU convo and let's do away with the top four. And while we're at it, and this is a completely different conversation, can we please do away with this Black Ivy League bull? It's stupid. It is really stupid to me. Here's my solution. My solution is to get out of the weeds of the debate, because every time we have the debate about top HBCUs, you want to know who gets caught in the weeds the most? HBCU alumni. HBCU alumni go at it with one another in this debate. You have the people who they get really personal about it. And then, you know, you have this situation where we are not talking about the value of HBCUs anymore. The debates get so heated sometimes that we are talking about what we don't like about certain HBCUs. And that does no one any good. So here's what I'm thinking. What I'm thinking is this. First of all, I think as a national alumni community of HBCUs, I think what we need to do is we need to dive into the research and look at all of the value points that we could possibly pick up. I think there is some research that was done 9 years ago that is still relevant today. It was research done by Gallup. And it looked at why is it that Black alumni of HBCUs thrive more than Black alumni from predominantly white institutions. That research made all the sense in the world to me as someone who got his undergraduate degree from a PWI. And the thing to really point out in this conversation that I think is a really salient point is that when it comes down to looking at the value, reaching back to this research, is that what we see in a lot of HBCU alumni, particularly those who got their undergraduate degrees from HBCUs, is that you see this consistency of people who have a strong sense of purpose, a strong sense of well-being, as that Gallup research pointed out, but then also their social mobility that other pieces of research have pointed out. People who can really say, started from the bottom, now I'm here because of my alma mater. And that is consistent among so many HBCUs, if not almost all HBCUs. And we are missing the beauty of that discussion when we have this top HBCU conversation. The other thing I want to point this out to, and I think this is really worth pointing out before I get back to my solutions here. We need to also bear in mind where some of this conversation comes from. And part of this conversation are the U.S. News and World Report rankings, which I am not a fan of. And so that, I think, has caused some separation, I think, throughout the HBCU community, aside from a few other issues when it comes down to private institutions versus state institutions, people who feel that they are not, they feel that certain institutions are educating Black students in a, shall we say, a not the most culturally appropriate way. All of these different aspects of the conversation bubble up. But I do think that the ranking conversation does add a bit to the confusion, because people have started to depend too much on the U.S. News and World Report rankings, which were not designed for schools like HBCUs in the first place, right? If you want to hear some great commentary on how flawed the U.S. News and World Report rankings are, check out 2021. There are two episodes of Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History, and they are about the U.S. News and World Report rankings. And part two of that series is this a two part series, but part two of that series is an episode called Project Dillard, where he interviewed Walter Kimbrough, who was then the president of Dillard University, about where there's tremendous value at a particular type of college, even though the college is well under resourced. The value is still there. And I think what that has done is that has really kind of bastardized our thought process when it comes to what makes a particular institution valuable. For HBCUs, if you want to take a look at the value, take a look at the alumni. As a matter of fact, in marketing, this is something that we know. The value of an institution is often found in the alumni and how the alumni present themselves. They give alumni, we give clues as to where the value of our experience was at our respective alma maters. So here's the other things to think about. And this is a very simple solution for us to really help improve the value of all of our HBCUs and to put the conversation about HBCUs in one very big, productive, not bucket, but pool. And that is donate. Donate where you can, however much you can, when you can. Believe me when I say this, for HBCUs, every little dime counts. I know this. I worked at three of them, right? Every bit counts. And for HBCUs, it's much better to have 100,000 people donating $50 than it is to have 1,000 people trying to donate $500. You're going to get much more if you get a bunch of people to donate. Donate to your alma mater. If you don't have an HBCU alma mater, but you got a couple in your city, donate a little bit to one, a little bit to another one, right? But if that's not the case, if you would rather donate to an umbrella organization, you have UNCF, you have the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. Make your donations wherever you can. Support events. For me and Halima, our new favorite New Orleans event is the UNCF Mayor's Mass Ball. An event that we love going to. It's a great event. It's become one of our favorites in the city. Happy to participate in that event. Also, build a community of advocates as an HBCU alum. Do it. Build that community. On the next episode of For Our Edification, episode 43, I'm going to have a conversation with George Sedbury. On social media, he's known as the White George. And he is, well, because he's white. And George, what he does is he advocates actively for HBCUs. And his story of why he does that is a pretty interesting story. And so he didn't go to one. I don't know if he ever intends to go to one, but he is proud to advocate for HBCUs. How can we build more advocates? It doesn't have to be white people. I'm talking about advocates, period. As a matter of fact, this takes me to my next point. How do we build more advocates for HBCUs among black folks who graduated from predominantly white institutions? How do we do that? Because I got to tell you something. I can't begin to tell you how much I hate the HBCU versus PWI debate that black folks like to have. It is so stupid. It gets nowhere. Everybody sits on social media and their Twitter fingers start going to town when somebody says something that somebody doesn't like. All somebody has to say is boo. And the next thing you know, the conversation blows up. And people are like children with this damn conversation. Stop it. Grow the hell up. Right? Have a solutions-oriented conversation. But here's what I need HBCU alumni to do. Be the leaders in the conversation. Lead the damn thing. Lead it, right? Somebody, some black graduate from XYZ University whose football team is on national TV every Saturday, they say something left. All right, fine. They said something left. Let them be their stupid selves. Let them be their uninformed selves. Try to bring them to the table, though. Educate them. Try to educate them. And I'm not saying that there are HBCU alumni who don't do it. I'm not saying that at all. But when I tell you that the sight of people beefing with one another on social media about which kind of institution is better, it's like I don't know if you've ever watched TED. But it's like this line that Mark Wahlberg has in TED. It's like a sword going through my brain, right? So stop it, y'all. Build advocates. Build a community. And this is the last thing that I would ask for us to focus on HBCUs as a valuable community. And that is talk about the community, but then also talk about each institution that you know of on its own merit. Whatever you know, whatever you can find out, whatever makes you say, what? I didn't know this institution did this. What? I didn't know so-and-so graduated from that institution. Talk about it. Let your social media fingers work on that. One community I will definitely applaud is there is a community of Redditors who graduated from HBCUs and who attend HBCUs. And there's an HBCU community on Reddit that to me is really helpful. As a matter of fact, they take the liberty of answering some really good questions that folks have. Let me just say this. If you're not into Reddit, I get it. But if you're not in Reddit, I get it. But if you're not into Reddit, I get it. But if you are on Reddit and you are an HBCU alum, check out the HBCU community. I love the way the people on the HBCU community and on Reddit, I love the way they address questions, especially sensitive questions. There are a lot of students who feel like outcasts in their communities because they're LGBTQ. They may have neurodivergency. There are a lot of white students who ask, will I be accepted if I attend an HBCU on Reddit? They're asking these questions. Be the leader. If you're on Reddit, go to that community, be the leader. And one of the things that I love about the HBCU Redditors is that they are very thoughtful in saying, well, you know what? Here's what I know of about these HBCUs. Here is what you may want to consider. But what do you really want? Where do you really want to go? What are you trying to major in? What kind of atmosphere do you want? That'll help us answer your question more thoughtfully. Damn it, that's what I'm talking about. That is leadership. And that's what we need in the HBCU community. Thank you so much for listening to me ramble and rant about Freaknik and also about not doing this top HBCU thing. Again, if you want to check out past episodes of For Our Edification, then go to eddiefrancis.com. We also have past episodes on YouTube and then also where you find your podcasts. And then also there are three things that I'm asking you to do: download, give feedback, and share. For Dr. Halima Lee Francis, an alumna of Hampton University, I'm Eddie Francis. Thank you for joining me or for our edification.